Robert Brugman says sprawl gets a bad rap. He also says that much of what we think we know about the suburbs and sprawl is simply wrong. He's the author of Sprawl, A Compact History, and says suburban sprawl has given us everything we cherish as Americans: privacy, mobility, and choice. Not a popular stance in a world where it seems everyone is decrying sprawl and celebrating so-called smart growth.
I think that sprawl is one of those terms that has never had an exact definition because the people who use it have very good reasons not wanting it to be defined very exactly, the biggest reason of which is that if they did, most of the people who are against it would realize they live in it. So I think that actually sprawl is just a bad diagnostic tool. It covers a lot of problems, some of them very important, like, let's say, global warming, some of them really pretty trivial, and it puts them all together in a big bag and assumes there's one single solution, which is higher density, less sprawl. And I don't think that either the diagnosis nor the prescription is a very good one.
Well, maybe we need to start then with a definition of sprawl so that we can have a reasonable discussion about the same thing.
Right.
What do you use as a definition of sprawl?
Well, for purposes of history, of doing a history of sprawl, I use a definition that it's less dense settlement than what went before, and it's often scattered, and there is no overarching master plan. And by that definition, sprawl is not, as most people, I think, recent American and driven by the automobile, but it's as old as urban history. And it's something that happens every time a new group of people is able to get out of the congestion of central cities. They've taken that opportunity.
I guess what occurs to me as we talk about it, though, is that each of us has a kind of emotional definition of sprawl. I think about the years when I lived on the East Coast and drove up and down the Boston Post Road, and it seemed as though you could drive forever and never leave the city. That was what I always thought of as sprawl, not going into the New Jersey countryside and discovering that there are some very beautiful places where people have nice houses and live quite comfortably.
Right. Well, and of course, I think for most people, going back to as long as people have been angry about sprawl, and that goes back all the way to the Roman times, that people were angry about people moving out of the city and cluttering up the countryside, the vast majority of these complaints are essentially aesthetic or, let's call it, symbolic. And that's fine. And everyone has a perfect right not to like that sprawl that you see when you drive between Boston and Washington. But I think that before we go trying to change the whole thing, we need to find out why it happened and all the benefits that it's created for millions of people over centuries. And I think only then are we really in a position to say, well, is this more important than our aesthetic preferences?
One of the things, though, that it seems obvious that sprawl is at the root of is this question of eating up the land and of increasing the reliance on the automobile to get us from here to there. Do you agree with that?
Yes, but we have to take each of them independently because they're completely different issues. Eating up the land. In the first place, at least in the United States, we've eaten up very little land. It's 5% or less. We could fit the whole population of the United States at suburban densities into the state of Wisconsin. There's plenty of land. It's not that we're lacking of it. Some people worry about agriculture. Agriculture, again, we are using less land than we were using, let's say, 30 years ago, but we're producing more because of the Green Revolution. Now, let's take the other question here, which is about transportation. People assume, and it's the first thing that people assume when they talk about sprawl in the United States, that because things are spread out more, that the business is further from the home and further from places of recreation, that therefore there have to be longer commutes, more congestion, more pollution. In fact, that equation is almost backward. That is, yes, the businesses have moved out and the people have moved out, but because both are moving out, it has not meant that commutes are longer, at least in time. In time, those commutes have remained relatively stable. They are still 20 to 30 minutes what they've been probably since the beginning of recorded history.
That seems counterintuitive if you're farther away from work, or is that the essence?
But you're not. But you're not further away from work. You may be physically a little bit further, but your speed of travel is much greater. And what's really made that happen is that the automobile is a much more efficient way of getting from point A to point B than public transportation in any city, except for a very few, very large cities to get from in the intermediate area into the center. So if you're in Paris or in New York and you want to get from the first suburb into the center, public transportation may be your fastest way to do it. anywhere else, and even in those cities, and not in that case, getting someplace by public transportation is almost always at least twice as time-consuming as it is to take the automobile. And that's why the automobile use has risen astronomically in Europe as it has in the United States. In fact, it's the same trajectory, just with a time lag.
Well, that makes sense. But what about those appalling McMansions that people build?
I think anyone that's trained in a particular set of aesthetic preferences that we can label as, I think, upper middle class, they are appalled by those McMansions. But, you know, I think if you take a bigger perspective on that and you look back only to, let's say, the 1880s or the 1920s, and you see the British aristocracy absolutely appalled at those houses that the wealthy bankers were putting up in the Cotswolds and the Chilterns outside of London, it's exactly the same aesthetic negative reaction, as is the case in the 1920s, when affluent people were going out to the suburbs and putting up big Tudor houses that, of course, the intellectual and artistic elite of the day thought was the most ridiculous thing they had ever seen and roundly disliked them. But in almost every one of these cases, one generation later, those very same people have changed their mind, and suddenly those things aren't so bad. In fact, they look pretty good, given the monstrosities that they, or what they believe to be the monstrosities going up in that day.
One of the illustrations that appealed to me in the book was of the row houses in the suburbs of London,
yeah,
which were denigrated by everybody. They thought they were just appalling.
Well, they were denigrated by people in the artistic and literary world. They certainly were not denigrated by the majority of Londoners, who were absolutely delighted to move into them.
A little bit of garden was
absolutely
appealing.
So when we're talking about aesthetics, I think it's the purest example of kind of class-based assumptions. I think that all the arguments about sprawl are heavily influenced by these class-based assumptions, but you see it most clearly when we're talking about aesthetics.
A lot of people talk about the solution to this whole thing being to increase the density of the inner cities, to go up rather than out.
Right, right.
Is there any indication that that is an effective response to the question of sprawl?
Well, it's an effective response if people are willing to do it. Now, if you had complete power, let's say you were in Soviet Union or you were in Hong Kong or Singapore, you can do that and get away with it. It's not possible in most cases to do it in the Western democracies, because if there's one thing people dislike more than sprawl at the edge, it's high density at the center if it's near them. And it's the very same people who are complaining if you build out in sprawl. They're the very same people who will complain if you're building higher density in the center city. What they'll say, and it's perfectly true, is that to do that destroys the character of the neighborhood in the central city.
Residential neighborhoods really don't want more large apartment buildings in them, do they?
Mostly. That's mostly true. And I should say that most people don't want to live in apartment buildings. Most people, and I'm talking worldwide now, when they're asked, and this has been tested in poll after poll after poll, where do you want to live? They may say single-family house, they may say bungalow, they may say cottage, they may say country house, but it's going to be some species of single-family detached house. In no poll have I ever seen anywhere have the majority of people said, oh, I want to live in an apartment building, I want to live in a big, tall high-rise. It's just not what most people seem to want.
So is what you're saying that we need to simply look more closely at the argument that we're having? I don't get the sense from you that you are opposed to the idea of urban planning.
No, not at all. No, not at all. I teach urban planning history. I believe in urban planning. But I think that with urban planning, there's been an unfortunate confusion about what it's supposed to do. I think that if urban planners said that their goal was to analyze very clearly what's out there, document that, put it into good, usable form, talk about the different alternative scenarios for future development, and then put those into the political arena to be decided by the political process, I don't think most people would have any problem with that. It's when something else happens. It's when planners or anyone else, architects or any other group, believes that because of their superior training, they have the right and the duty to decide how other people should live. And therefore, rather than taking the time to really look carefully at what's there, they jump to the next step, decide what they think it should be, and therefore they're proselytizing on behalf of a particular outcome. That, I think, has been the problem in this whole debate.
It sounds to me as though you're almost saying sprawl is going to happen no matter what you do. And you ought to stop worrying about sprawl and start worrying about the specific issues that are of concern to you, sprawl not being essentially one of them.
Well, I think that rather than say that, I would say that there are a lot of issues involved with what people call sprawl, and they're very different and they have very different solutions, and that, yes, we ought to be looking specifically at species protection or global warming or problems of concentrated poverty. These are real problems. We need to address them. But I don't think they're all the same thing or they have the same solutions. In fact, sometimes the solutions go in different directions altogether. This is a very complicated issue, and many of the places that we're talking about, let's say the Napa Valley and in California, very few people consider that sprawl at all, partly because it's wealthy people with very good taste, and that's hardly ever considered sprawl, no matter how low density it is. And it's partly because these are people who have tried to keep it looking rural as much as they possibly can.
Sprawl is the Boston Post Road, not Napa Valley.
That's exactly right.
Robert Brugman's the author of Sprawl, A Compact History.